Okay, so you are very welcome to this week's episode of the Hot Seat Podcast. We have another wonderful guest in the hot seat this week. Slightly different because it's not our usual musical guest, but we do have a talented poet, pioneer. There's a lot of things that are going on here. We have Jeff. So a lot of you guys may know him as the poet Jeff. So you're very welcome to the show and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on. Like, I really, really appreciate the opportunity. I've loved the shows that you're doing. I think you've a really unique way of interviewing people. So yeah, great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Emil. Can we get to basics first off? Because I mean, I know you as a performer and a poet. I'm not sure if our fan base would be familiar with yourself. So can you give us a bit of background into how you got started with your poetry?
I suppose I've always written poetry. Like, I started when I was in school, and I was cripplingly shy in school. Like, I was the kid that nobody kind of knew or noticed the whole way through school, and that was okay with me. That was what I wanted. And then when I started to kind of speak up in class and give my opinions and stuff, I loved English. You know what I mean? I loved reading, and I really enjoyed poetry. I mean, like, the first poem that I can ever remember connecting with was like Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken, and it kind of explained to me like who I was as a person, that it was okay to be different. So when I started giving my opinion in poetry class, I was told it was wrong, and that just like really set me back and really kind of pissed me off, you know. So then I was like, oh, well, look, if I can't give my opinion on poetry, I'll just write it, you know, like, which is a bizarre way to be, you know. I rebelled by writing poetry, which is just ridiculous. So then I started then, and then I kind of, as I was getting on later in my teens and stuff, and early 20s, I started DJing, which was grand, because I didn't have to, I could kind of hide behind decks and stuff, and I DJed house parties and the likes of that. And then from that I got into like writing music for bands, and I even tried my hand at rapping, which was an absolute mitigated disaster. Like, Jesus Christ, like, it was really bad. And so then it was like a bit later on, then I just came back to poetry, and I'd always been writing, you know. So I think it was, I started to just kind of feel more kind of comfortable and confident in being myself, and I suppose that's where the poetry comes, and that's where you kind of find your voice and find that it's okay to kind of speak your own truths and stuff. So like that came to me a bit a while later, and then but I didn't know that there was a poetry scene, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't, nobody, you never think that anybody's ever going to listen or read any of the stuff that you've written. You know, it's very personal, but even just being like honest to yourself kind of takes a while to get to. And then I saw that there was a scene in Dublin, and one of my mates brought me to an open mic night, and it was the Monday Echo, and I was like, what the hell is this? Like, there's other poets, like, this is just, it was just so strange. And I started getting into that way, and I started just going to open mics, and I love the open mic scene in Dublin so much. I still love it, you know what I mean, all these years later. I love the immediacy of it, that you can write a piece in the morning and be up on stage that evening, and that there's no boundaries, there's no censorship. You can talk about what you want, and it's just there, and I think there's a lovely community there, very supportive community. So yeah, I did a load of open mics, and then got my first feature, and kind of just went from there, really. Yeah.
Wow, and it is completely unknown about the poetry community that's here. Like, I mean, I only came across that from being at gigs where poets were included. Like, if I hadn't been exposed to that, you really wouldn't be aware of it as such. It's funny that you were saying that in poetry class you were told that, like, your opinion was wrong, so you kind of rebelled by writing poetry. Now, your style of writing is very unique. It's not the typical poetry structure that we follow. Do you think that that's maybe why you were told that your opinion was wrong, or do you think that maybe that kicked you into the style of writing that you do now?
That's a brilliant question. Well, I don't know. Like, I think that I think, but somebody came up to me one day and asked me about a poem that I wrote, and they said, "Did you mean this?" And I didn't mean that, but I told them I did, because I think once you put a poem out there, people look at it from their own viewpoint and their own experiences and their own lens of looking at those words or listening to those words, we all pick up different things from art. So, and that's what I was doing in poetry class, and it's wrong to do it that way, because if you want to get marks, you need to know that Yeats's love was Maud gone, and in this poem that there was something about the relationship and he was trying to do this, and if you want to get up the marks in your Leaving Cert, that's the way you have to go. And I just think that's really the wrong way to look at art, you know what I mean? Because like, it takes away the feeling and the intimacy of the piece and the person, you know? Like, so I was looking at it in the way that I saw the fit, you know, in the piece. I was like, God, that really reminds me of this, and this is how I feel about this particular poem. So then I don't know, maybe that does has got into my style. I think my style changes a lot. Like, I think there was two people that really kind of impacted the way that in which I write. It was The Streets. I love listening to The Streets, and Scroobius Pip as well, from Scroobius Pip, or Dan the Sack versus the Scroobius Pip. It's the early 2000s, and I thought that they spoke about stuff that was really difficult for me to talk about, like growing up and coming of age and getting into trouble and doing all the things you weren't supposed to do, and I thought there was a bravery in what they were saying. So that kind of freed me up to write stuff about my own life. And then once I started writing, like, it just became brutally honest. I think I don't hide anything in any of the stuff that I write. I try and show all my vulnerabilities. I don't try and show, but that's just the way it became. And the mad ironic thing is that, like, later on, I heard an interview between Scroobius Pip and The Streets, and they were saying that they weren't honest, they were just creating characters and writing narratives around the characters to do it. So but it didn't matter. At that stage, I was already freed to write the way I wanted. So yeah, I didn't realise that I had a unique style. That's mad.
Yeah, no, I think you definitely do. And with the whole, like, being vulnerable and allowing yourself to come through, I mean, that's really in your poem, The First Kiss. I remember the first time I heard that was in The Workman's. And you got up on stage and you were doing it, and I was sitting there and I was just latching on to every word, and I could nearly feel all the emotions, like, that you had been going through and all the different ages and stuff and the stories. Do you think that when you're writing the poems that you're kind of conscious of how you're going to perform it, or is it just when you write the lyrics and then that just determines your performance on the day? I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, I write to a rhythm in my head, so with the narrative structure, I'll write it out. I go back and I edit quite a lot, and so when I'm writing it, at the beginning I'll write a few different versions of it to try and get to what I'm trying to say, and sometimes it can take me like 3 or 4 poems to get to the poem that I want to write. And with First Kiss, I knew that I wanted to talk about, like, being a child and the innocence of playing football and how young and how like self-conscious I was. But and then I wanted to try and make it into a three-act structure. So I kind of had, it took me a while to get to that, like, to have a three-act, to have it, like, to see Kate in the story and to kind of have fallen in love with her, but not being able to say it to her, and then, like, bringing her out to the dance and you know, and getting there and almost getting there and it not working and being so distraught, and then the final thing of, you know, coming back when I'm 16 and not really being confident, but just drinking my way into confidence and still just trying to get there. So then, but then when I started to perform it and when I started to say it out, when I'm it's the same with a lot of my poems, I then edit it as I'm learning it off. So I'll see what kind of fits and what doesn't. And if the rhythms fit, and if it's going on too long, so it's they both kind of work into each other, but definitely the core message of what I'm trying to say is, like, the initial idea is key. Do you know what I mean? Like, no matter what else comes, it's like when I'm editing, or when I'm doing anything, is like, does this add anything to the piece? And if it doesn't, I'm just really rootless and I just like scrap it and get rid of it and go back to what is like, this is what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Very good. So you nearly kind of structure it like a story with like a start, a middle, and an end. Would you kind of take the same approach with, I mean, we've had other poems from you where you've challenged the government, you've challenged homelessness. What's the approach when writing those kind of poems?
I get really angry and really pissed off at something, and then I decide that I'm going to try and write something to make a difference, which is a really bizarre thing to say because it's just a poem, you know what I mean? And then so with the Letter to Leo piece, I was sitting in my house and Hazel Hogan, another poet, and me and her were talking. She set up a group, but she was like, oh, there's the census after coming out that shows that there's like over 3,000 homeless children in Ireland, and there's like, I think it was nearly 9,000 homeless people. She was like, I'd really like to do something with this. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I live in a society where there's that many homeless children. Like, we're supposed to be one of the richest countries in the world. How can we have so many children that are homeless? And then I was like, okay. And I wrote the first, I said, let's just write something and let's just perform it outside the Dáil in a protest and get the cameras to come and see. I didn't even know how I was going to do it. I just knew that I just wanted to perform it outside the Dáil. I kind of like, I just wanted to do it as like, just wanted to bring a focus onto it. Do you know what I mean? Because it was like, how many of these senses have come out that nobody's seen about it? So then I wrote the first piece about it, and it just came to like, Dear Leo, you know, that was the first lines. So I started to, I wrote the first verse, so I didn't have to research anything about the first verse because it was just a question. But then I was like, okay, now I need to know what I'm talking about. I don't want to go into this like just somebody who's angry from the sidelines, just ranting and going, this is terrible, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you know, so I just researched it for a couple of months and looked at stories and looked at figures and looked at like what was happening with people in hotels, which I just couldn't believe at the time. And then I started to piece it together. And then like, but another piece that I've done more recently, the Gloke piece with the travelling community, I knew that there was a huge amount of kind of racism towards travellers. And I also knew that like the suicide rates in travellers are like much higher, they're nearly 10 times more than the general population. So I thought that like, I've been doing workshops with different groups, and I thought that I might be able to incorporate some of the workshops I've done with the travelling community. And I approached Pavy Point, and then the workshops were supposed to be around kind of challenging mental health through creative writing and poetry. But they became so much more than that. And then it ended up that like over the 6 weeks, there was so much hurt and so much pain and anguish and kind of just like you could feel the racism that was felt. And even like I'd go out for drinks with the lads, and you just the racism, it just never stopped. It was the discrimination was there constantly, you know, like they'd book a place in a pub and then they'd go in and then they'd go in as a group and one of the lads would be late, and then that lad wouldn't get in, and the doorman would stop him because he was a traveller. And I was like, this is just wrong. So then it was just workshops with them. Then I went off and I wrote that piece over the course of a couple of weeks. And yeah, so it does go into, I kind of just like envelop or envelope myself. No, that's just not the right word. What's the word I'm looking for? I just go into it like fully. I kind of like encase myself in the subject matter for a long time. And it can, like, and it has its drawbacks. Like, a lot of the time, it kind of has negative impacts on my mental health, and people get worried because I'm in so deep. But then, if I want to write something that's truthful and real and raw, you kind of have to go to some dark places sometimes to get a real sense of what you're trying to write about, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, and to challenge that a little bit, do you feel like you're writing them for you, or do you feel like you're writing them because it could potentially make a difference? Like for you to embed yourself into it and to go into those kind of dark places to get the stuff out there, is that just because you need to get stuff off your chest, or is there somewhere in the back of your mind that you think, oh, well, this could potentially help people down the line?
You are a brilliant interviewer. Like that's what a wonderful. This is really challenging for me. No, it's great. I thought, you know what? Like, probably, yeah. You know, like probably a bit of both. You know, my mom says that like since I was a young child, I always told her that I wanted to make a difference. You know, that I wanted to make the world a better place. I've never really said that out loud to anybody, but so I think there's probably part of that would be the kind of the selfish part of these pieces for myself would be that it's the way that I can see if I can challenge things and kind of make the difference. But I do care about it, you know, like I like any of the subjects that I go into. They are things that I genuinely care about, and that I don't just, it doesn't just stop at the poem for me, you know. Like, I've made a lot of friends in the travelling community, and that project was supposed to go for 6 weeks, and it's 2 years down the line, and I'm still doing stuff with the community, you know, and still challenging kind of stereotypes and working, and that's a project that will go on, and might even go on for the rest of my life, you know. So, I don't know if that answers your question, though. Like, yeah, I think it's a bit of both. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that you're putting the words down on paper, you're vo like voicing them to a group of people, because you are then putting in the work behind that to help organisations or to help out groups. Like, you're doing the workshops there with Pavi Point. What was it like when you began that? Like, was there some sort of like animosity around it when you walked in first, or were you just ready to get in and make a difference?
I like a lot of times when I go into workshops. It's the same, like not all the time, but a lot of the times I'll go in, like the people there, the only experience they have of poetry would be school, which is like, and it's not a great experience really for many people. Like it's really just breaking down the nuts and bolts and the techniques and the you know, all the crappy stuff about poetry that, like, so to take the joy and the love out of it. So like, with Pavi Point, because discrimination there is so high, sometimes they've had people who want to work with them but would have an agenda. This is what they've told me. You know, so that the person comes in, does the thing, then goes, the person's got funded, got paid, does a little project and is gone, and that's the end of it. And they kind of, they're kind of defensive around that, or they when I was going in, that you could see that there was the men there were kind of defensive. So I just go in and I lay myself down on at the beginning of the workshops, and I tell people who I am, and I'm trying to be as honest as I possibly can, because trust is really important, you know. And I think I need the people in the workshops to trust me. If we're going to get to any of the stuff that's really important, if they're going to tell me things, and if we're going to share, then I have to let them know who I am before I can ask them questions about who they are. So, like at the beginning of the workshops, it did take a couple of weeks to get to the stage, and they were and it was like, why are you here? And I'm like, well, I'm here because suicide rates in male travellers are massively high, and you know, female travellers are incredibly high too. I said, but like. So I want to try and challenge that. They were like, but why are you here? And I'm like, but that's kind of it. And then, like in some of the groups more recently, and I've done more and more workshops with the, like the last workshop I did was around homelessness in travellers. And they were like young guys, and they were like, but like it took, like the workshop was meant to, my funding was for 6 weeks, and it took 6 months. So like, I didn't get paid for 4.5 months of that, you know what I mean? Like, well, it's not about getting paid, but I had to show that I had to build up trust. So I was on WhatsApp groups with them 24 hours a day. They were calling me during the week, and then it became like we built up friendships. And then it was only like at the very end, like months and months and months of work, at the very end, they were like, okay, we'll come in for the groups now. And then it was like, right, we're ready to go. So yeah, it just. It's just, I suppose it's a different way of working, you know.
Yeah, I suppose when you have people who come in and they're just there to get paid and do their thing and leave, it is hard then or the group to trust you as a new person coming in, because they're probably like, oh sure, this fella's just going to do the same. How did you notice things change, and then over time, like obviously it took you a couple of weeks, as you said there, it took you nearly what, a month or two to actually get through to them. How did you notice a transition then amongst the group over the rest of the period that you were working with them?
I don't know. It was one of the, like, I suppose that it was, there is, like, when I'm in a workshop normally, we'd work through some stuff in the workshop, and towards the end of the workshop, we'll write together. People write their own individual pieces, or I'll go over and I'll help some people write a piece, and then we'll finish off, and that we'll have something at the end of the workshop. But the workshops in Pavey Point were so intense that we weren't getting to the point of writing at the end of them. And I was really nervous. I was like, oh my God, like we haven't written. And the lads were like, we're not writing this. This is, and there was these big beats going on there, which were really important, really important debates. But obviously, like, we're not writing. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, we're not writing. We're not, like, where are we going to do? Where is this going? But I just was like, oh, just trust yourself and just trust the process and just keep on going. And then as it came to, I think it was like week, but like in those workshops, it was like week four, and I said to the lads, I was like, look, there's some really important stuff here. And I said, I would like to, if with their consent, write a piece about their lived experiences and bring it back, and then that would be the focal point of the workshop. So they were really happy with that, and they trusted me. And when I wrote the piece and brought it in on the last week, and it was a really scary and emotional moment, because it's so raw, it's so raw. And I was like, I don't know if they're gonna like this or not, like, but I've just been as truthful as I possibly can be. And I recited it for them, and there was just this silence for ages. I was like, oh shite. And then they were like, yeah, that's it. That's it. I was like, what do you want me to change to? Like, nothing. And they're like, are you going to say that? Are you going to say that out in front of the minister? I was like, yeah. They're like, where are you going to do it? I was like, well, it's going to be in the Chamber of Commerce. That the it was the first fortnight festival that had kind of commissioned me at that stage, and so it's going to be the focal point of the first fortnight festival. So they want this read out in front of the one of the ministers of cabinet in the Chamber of Commerce. And they're like, and can we be there? It's like, yeah, that's the whole point. You're going to be there. And they were like, and you're going to say all of that? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to say all this. Right, fucking brilliant. Let's do that then. I'm like, okay, yeah. So it was brilliant. And then it was like, because I think I like they this is what they told me. They were like, they told me that I went to places that other people were afraid. So I'd go to the sites, and I'd spend days in the sites walking around with the lads, and I kind of get to know what it was, what the life that they had. You know what I mean? It didn't just start and stop in the workshops. That it was like, as I said, I tried to become part of the piece and see the reality of it, so that I can try and make it as truthful as possible. So yeah, and I'm really proud of that piece and those workshops. Like, it was the difficult challenge. And even, like, there was parts of it, like the guys in First Fortnight, when I was reporting back to them, and that they were like, Jeff, like, we think you need to go to counselling, like, you're really down. I'm like, yeah, this is really hard, because I have never seen this level of discrimination before on a regular basis. Like, and it's every week, and I don't know what to do, because I can't change it. Like, and I feel helpless. And so yeah, it took a lot out of me, that one, yeah. But it's great. I'm delighted with it,
Yeah, I'd say it is pretty challenging, but there's so many benefits to it for yourself and for them. We know that you are kind of a pioneer for a lot of charities, and you're always highlighting issues that are going on. Talk to me about your work for homelessness. We've seen you do plenty of gigs, and tickets for the gigs are go straight to homeless charities, or else you send around a little donation box and all that money goes to homelessness. Tell me a little bit about your dedication towards that.
I didn't know I had a dedication. I don't know. Like, I think it's just like I'm in a really, like, kind of privileged position, and like, it's nice to be able to make a difference. Do you know what I mean? And it's nice to be able to just highlight issues. And I'm lucky that, I have a really nice life. you know, I don't want for an awful lot of things, and like I have a home, and you know, I like when it comes to gigs like that for charity, and people ask me to do it, like I will always do it because, like all it takes for me is to perform, and we can sell tickets, and we can raise a little bit of money, and we can kind of make a difference and highlight the issue. So, like, it was great that the piece, like the Letter to Leo piece, became like the flagship for the My Name Is campaign, which was to kind of highlight child and give voices to the children who were homeless. And they put my poem on this massive big letter, like to Leo Varadkar, and we presented it to him on the first day the Dáil resumed back in January, I think it was, or February, one year. And so yeah, I think like if you're going to do something, like do it properly and follow it through. And it's great, we've been able to do some stuff for like Pieta House and the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre as well, and like charities that don't get enough funding from the government, you know what I mean, that are out on their own, that and they're doing such important and amazing work. So like if we can do a gig that raises a little bit of money for them, yeah, absolutely, yeah, it's great. I love those gigs the most, to be honest with you. Do you know, there's like a sense in the crowd as well that you're part of something, you know, and that you're in this together, and that you're doing something substantial, you know. Yeah.
There's always a good atmosphere there because, I mean, you can enjoy the night and you know that's going towards a
Yeah.
good cause as well. Do you find it a little bit ironic from doing poems that are challenging the government and that are highlighting issues that the government maybe have caused or aren't addressing to then going to write a poem for the 100th anniversary of the Dáil being in place?
No, because like I really believe in Ireland, you know. I really believe in democracy, and I really believe in the republic of this country. And I'm really proud that we're a republic. And I think, you know, if you believe in democracy, you need to be part of it, and you need to be an active member of that society. So I email TDs and councillors, and I you know, tell them what I think, and I challenge them on different votes in the Dáil. So like as much as I don't agree with some of the policies that are there and what the government has done, I love that we have a democracy in which I can vote, you know, in the last time, the last general election. I mean, Sinn Féin got a huge amount of the vote, and for the first time in the history. So there was this really kind of nail biting finale until Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael came together for some mad reason. And so I do love Ireland, you know what I mean? Like and like writing the piece about the formation of the Dáil was a huge privilege. I never thought I'd get to do anything like that. You know, like I still can't believe I've done it. You know, so when the Lord Mayor was like, you know, we'd love you to write this, I thought, well, okay. So that was this. Just, I love the challenge of something like that. You know what I mean? I should be more scared about when I'm writing something like that, because it's like in 50 years, 100 years' time, that poem will be kind of taken out by people and read again. And it had to be done properly and done right. And I wanted to give it a bit of a, you know, come on, up blading Ireland at the end of it, you know. So I really loved writing it, and I'm delighted. Yeah, but I think you can love your country and challenge the ideals of it at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely does because I mean the formation of the first Dáil has a huge story behind it, and to where we are now may not be the exact representation of it,
Yeah.
but it comes with different challenges.
Absolutely, yeah.
I believe you are going to perform a little piece for us.
Yes, I was gonna do one. It's called No Take Backs, and it's just about growing up in Dublin. Yeah, and I wrote this one actually. I got the idea for it after I was me and Emma Kieran sat down for a coffee one day, and we were kind of chatting, and yeah, and this poem kind of came about my walk home. It goes, I come from a Dublin that's old school. were home truths and youths in shiny tracksuits. I'd come from a place where the best haircut was the step. People got wrecked and we were just let roam the streets freely. My gang is 10 deep. We'd spend our days hanging around corners, and when night came upon us, we became night crawlers, getting into trouble running back to our mothers. Yeah, we were right little gurriers. See, those days were simple for us. Getting into trouble, getting out without much of a fuss. If we needed a ball, we'd doctor a car for sponsorship. Door-to-door chances. Would you sponsor us, miss? Get just enough money for a cup champion football and a few bag of chips. See, this is the innocence that I miss. I remember the first time when the lads had a dirty mag. I remember how big I missed Halloween because he got sick after smoking fags. I remember being served at 15 and drinking cans with the lads. I remember when Git told me. He kicked a needle out of one of the lads ODing in the flats. But we were cocky little chaps. Hair gelled up with our eyes under baseball caps. We'd slag off girls because we didn't want them to know that we liked them. Or that we were into them. Or that we'd spend all night dreaming and kissing them, then pretend that we hadn't spent all day looking at them, but the lads take the absolute piss out of us because we wouldn't admit that we wanted to wear the face off them. As nights had faded, I got back to me gaff. Spent some time with me dad and watched TV for a laugh, because ours was a house that was always full of laughter. Even when my brother died. Even when my dad asked his company and the banker at the door demanded money to take our house. Me in the corner, quiet as a mouse. Seeing this strange man shout me out and giving out because the house was in her name and they could fuck right off. Years after that were tight. But my ma was a fighting chief for all of us. When things were rough, she was there to pick us up. But to cover a hole in me runner with cardboard, she'd laugh and say, "You'd be grand son once it doesn't rain," and that stopped making it awkward. This matriarch of incredible heart is the hero of this story, since she once told me, "They can take anything, son. They can't take your education." These are the words I've lived my life on. And when others were out gurrying, I was in studying. When I didn't get the exact exam results I wanted and started worrying, she was there to comfort me, to encourage me, to keep on going. And every time I get hockeyed out of it by life, I just think of me dad and his wife. How they didn't raise their kids to cry or to think their fate wasn't on their side. They taught us to never feel sorry. Because no matter what life takes, once you're educated, you can take it back. And sometimes I look back at those lads in the flats with their hair gelled up and the eyes under baseball caps and I think, what if they'd listened to the words of me ma? They could still be here. Instead, they're either dead or they're strung out with smack. Thank you.
Wow. That was amazing. Well done.
I haven't actually performed in ages. It's been really lovely to say a poem out loud again.
Yeah, I'd say like the whole missing performance, I'd say that has a huge effect on you, like for someone who spends a lot of time on stage and then to have that all taken away.
Yeah, it's been really challenging, like, but it's because I just stopped writing for so long, then I just was like this, I didn't have anything to write about. I had everything to write. There's everything to write about. You can write about anything. You know what I mean? But I just didn't feel like any inspiration. And I don't like writing at home. I like writing out in the city. Like I walk around the city and I'll try and find like glimmers of ideas that along the streets and signs or people or something that somebody says. And that's where I get my, you know, most of my inspiration from. And then I'll go to a coffee shop or a bar and I go and just, you know, some place I go and get the same pint of Guinness and sit there and write a poem before I finish the pint. That's kind of like the goal. But when it was taken away and you can't go, and there's nowhere to go. So I did, like when I'm at home, I was working at home and eating at home and sleeping at home, and I just didn't feel like this is the place that I wanted to write. And it's only in the last kind of couple of months that I've started to write again and enjoyed writing again and found different places around that I can go. I suppose the kind of weather drying up as well has been good, so I've just been kind of going to the park and a couple of places around the city and just sitting down and writing away. So it's been great, but then it's like, what do I do with the poems now, you know, because there's nowhere to perform, there's nowhere to hear them. But like I've got a gig coming up at the end of the beginning of next month, which is great. I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to being on stage again, and there's some amazing performers on it. It's like Hazel Hogan, Emma O'Brien, Lethal Dialect, Emma Kirwan, and Handsome Paddy. It's for the Connolly Festival, so I can't wait. I haven't been this excited with a gig in so long. I'm like, when they ask me to do it, I'm like, I feel like a child, you know. Like, you can even see me, like, my face just lighting up. I'm like, I can't wait. What am I gonna do? What am I gonna wear? You know, what am I gonna do with my hair? All of the stupid things. But yeah, it's great. Yeah, to perform some new stuff as
Amazing.
well is gonna be brilliant.
Yeah, I'd say the first few months were quite challenging to not have those inspirations around you. Did you kind of come up with little quirky ways to keep yourself creative or motivated, or did you just say, I need to give this a break for a couple of months and just get through things?
I think, like, some other poets who I've kind of helped and done workshops with, they've kind of done workshops with, come to my workshops. They were kind of emailing me and messaging me and be like, "Oh, I can't write at the moment. What I do? How do you get out of writer's block?" And I was just saying to them, and I was just trying to take the same advice myself that I was giving to others. Was like, we're in this really weird situation, so like, just trust that it's gonna end and that inspiration will come back again. And to just be nice to yourself in the meantime, and not worry about it. And I know you had Greg Clifford on, and he went the opposite way with lockdown. Like, he just became this like powerhouse of creativity. He was just like plowing everything into it. It was like, I'm after writing another load of songs, and I'm after my book is finished and my album's done and this and that. And he's like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I wrote one poem over 6 months. But then I was trying not to judge myself too harshly, because I knew that the process would come back again, and it has. You know what I mean? Like, I did a piece with a London artist called 20 Pegs. He got in contact with me to write a lockdown piece, and we kind of took the temperature of how people were feeling, and from England and in Ireland, and then I wrote a piece around that, and that then kind of kick-started everything again for me. I really enjoyed that project, and I've been writing loads, and I've got an amazing project again with an Irish street artist called Bipolar Bear, where I'm writing a piece around kind of like, it's kind of mental health, but I'm using his words, and I'm using like what it's like to feel depressed and to be down. And to let people know that we're there for them, and to try and, some people go on like, when they're really depressed or bipolar, would go on like dark walks and look for signs to see, is anybody there out there listening? And we're trying to create those signs to show people that, we're here and we're listening, and maybe some of the words that we put on walls are going to be a sign for somebody to let them know that they're loved. Yeah, so that's the
Yeah.
project around.
Amazing. That's like a little touch of magic there that you're adding to people's lives. You mentioned there about the project that you'd done with 20 Pegs, that was called The Gloaming,
Yeah.
and that also took us on a journey. I mean, the first half of that piece, we were just engrossed in how kind of awful things were, but then it switched up and it just showed like brighter days and kind of got you excited for the future. How did you manage to transition or get the smooth transition between those two moods?
Jesus, Jesus, your questions are challenging. I don't know. Like, I think I try and bring hope into some of the stuff that I do. Like, I try and, there's a balance in the way that I write, so that like, that I try and not just like hammer down one point the whole time. Like, this is how I feel, and I'm with the gloaming. Like, I wanted it to be like, how do you feel? Like, how are people feeling? And everybody was down. And I think like somebody said to me, they were like, they've forgotten how to interact with people, because it'd been so isolating. And that was the opening line to the poem. I think I've forgotten how to say hello, not just to, friends, but or not just to strangers, but the people I know. And that kind of started it. And then I was like, but it can't be like this, you know, that there has to be, it has to, like, it's coming towards an end, and as dark as it is, and as dim as the light is at the end of the tunnel, it's still lit, and there's still something to hope for, and things will go back, and we will be able to, you know, to hug someone and hug people. Like, all I wanted to do, all I've wanted to do for a year is hug my ma and dad. You know, they've been cocooning in their house, and all I want to do is just hold them, and something so simple that you never thought, like, that's the goal, you know. And yeah, so that's just became it, that I didn't want it to be all doom and gloom, you know what I mean, kind of that yin and yang type of thing, that we'll start off with the how challenging it's been, and then try and bring some hope and joy into the, towards the end of it. Yeah, and I hope that that's how it came across.
Yeah, do you think that the wanting to go and hug your mum and dad, do you think that was the kind of driving force behind that brighter side of the poem, or like, were you really trying to convince yourself? Because I mean, the time when that poem came out was when the whole nation was at rock bottom.
Yeah.
So to be able to hear those words coming from you was uplifting for us, but how was it for you to write it? Like, did you have to convince yourself, or was it that image of getting to see your mum and dad?
No, it was, we did like a couple of questions on Instagram. We put up like polls on Instagram, like it was just really simple questions, like how are you feeling, what are you looking forward to. There was three questions, I can't remember what the other one was, and we put them up, and then so people gave their answers to it. So a lot of it was used from the stuff that people were talking about, you know. And I'm kind of very optimistic anyway, you know, like a lot of this stuff, I kind of look back on a lot of the stuff that I've written, and even the piece that I did there for you, like there's so much darkness in it, you know what I mean, like, but it's built up resilience in me, you know, my upbringing and the challenges that I faced have made me resilient, and so I look towards that, like, the best possible scenario a lot of the time, and I knew I was like, this is a hard place that I'm in, and I don't know anybody that hasn't had days where they're just like, I just want to go to bed and go to sleep and just wake up and hopefully tomorrow will be different, and just be really down and really insta, and so I was like, so I knew that was there, but I just wanted to shed a little bit of light in people's lives. And I don't think I've ever had such a positive reaction to any of my poems. Like the messages that like both me and 20 Pegs got back online was phenomenal, you know, like, and I think that like those messages are probably the reason why I started writing again and being kind of like, it was a really cathartic for me to just get rid of all of that kind of lockdown, I can't write, I'm stuck, I'm, you know, it's hard, it's dark, there's nowhere to go, you can't see anybody, and so it was just, yeah, it was just nice to just, like, connect with people again, I suppose is the real thing, you know what I mean, because there was a massive connection with the public around it, yeah, and I think that, like, life is beautiful, you know, like, it does get dark, and like, I mean, there is some of the challenges that life throws at you are really horrible, and I mean, they bring you down to the lowest of low, you know, you can have your heart ripped away, you can lose people that you love so much and your best friends, and you know, like, and it is very, very challenging, but there's also the other side of life where you can fall in love with your soulmate, or you can have people that genuinely care about you and want you to do well. And you can see, you can, you know, like at the moment, I'm a gobshite really, but like at the moment, I'm just looking forward to seeing the cherry blossoms bloom, you know, I'm going to go up to the Memorial Gardens and just, I'm going up every week, I'm like, when are the cherry blossoms in the Memorial Gardens, because the whole place is just mad pink, and you can just sit down and the blue sky and the pink, and it's just beautiful, and it's only there for about a week, and it's gorgeous, and that's what I'm living for at the minute, you know. So it's the little things, you know what I mean? It doesn't always have to be that. And I think being online at the moment is so hard, because so many people put this illusion of life that's there, and people get caught up because we want to come out of our own lives, and we want to see it, and we live in the falseness, or we can live in the falseness of what others put up or what others perceive their life to be. But like, everybody has their hard times, but everybody can find beauty too, and that's kind of what the gloaming was about, that to try and catch both of those things. Yeah,
and it definitely did, and as I said, it gave us a bit of brightness and a bit of hope to hold on to. Things have started to look up for you since the release of that. Like you just said, you have a gig coming up now in a couple of weeks. Tell us a little bit more about that. I'm assuming it's going to be a live stream gig because we're still not back to venues just yet.
Yeah. Well, we're recording it. It's going to be on stage in the new theatre, and then it's on the 7th of May. It's the Connolly Festival. I believe it's free. I believe all the tickets are free and you can just tune in. The lineup is amazing, you know, like myself and Emin O'Brien perform an awful lot together. We have this weird relationship that we just kind of push each other constantly, you know, like, so I love performing with Emmett, and Hazel Hogan is one of my favourite, you know, poets. She's just, her words are just so beautiful and so powerful. And then like Emma Kirwan is, you know, a hero of mine, and I get to be on the same stage as him again, which is amazing. And then a little dialect, like he's just ridiculous, you know, like his last album is like a powerhouse. So I haven't met him before, and I've never obviously performed with him. So it's going to be great to share the stage with those. And then Handsome Paddy is going to, you know, wreck the gaff with a big, like, DJ set at the end of it. So yeah, it's gonna be lovely, you know, and it just being on stage and just, you know, having an audience. Like, I don't have any books, and my book has been in the works for years, and I think the reason I don't have a book is because I just love performing so much, and I love sharing my pieces with people in the way that they're in my head. And I think the only way I can do that is when they're in my voice. And I love that connection with an audience, and I love the intimacy of that. And just sharing that space the whole time. So yeah, I cannot wait to get back up on stage, and I can't wait. And the last gig that I did was for the social sessions in Ferrer and Draper or Drapier, I don't know what the name of the place is, on South William Street, and it was tiny. There was about like 20 people there, and it was just so intimate, and I loved every moment, every second of that gig. I just appreciated being there so much. I just appreciated the audience spending that time with me and wanted to come and see me, like, because it had been so long, you know, since I'd done a gig before that. So it was like, you know, I think that, like, one of the things about lockdown is, like, I appreciate how, like, I think I've always appreciated how lucky I am to be a performer, and I really do suffer with kind of imposter syndrome, like wondering why people do come in and see me or pay money to see me even, and like, I think it just really kind of taking it all in at the moment and saying that, you know, people actually do appreciate the words that I write, which is lovely, and there's not a day goes by that I don't know how lucky I am to be in this position, you know.
Yeah, and I'd say the gig might be a little bit weird because obviously you're not going to have an audience, but you're still going to be surrounded by so many wonderful acts that are also performing. So I'd say they'll probably give you more energy than an audience would, like, by the names of people that you've listed.
If I'm performing to an empty room, I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to give it every ounce of energy that I have in my body. I got to give it for anybody that's listening. I'm going to come off stage and collapse. I'm going to just get, like, everything I have in me is going into this, because I can't wait. I feel like it's Christmas, you know. I genuinely feel like this is, like, you know, like a kid at Christmas. I get to be on stage again. Brilliant. Daddy.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. And I can't wait to see that as well, because, I mean, the lineup is excellent, and we know what you're like as a performer as well.
Thank you.
You had briefly mentioned about Emmett O'Brien. We had him on the show a couple months ago as well.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your friendship with him, because I see you guys nearly as like brothers who are just constantly annoying each other and egging each other on. And But still, just wanting them to do better. Like, so tell me a little bit about that friendship.
It's been really wonderful for me, you know. The first time I saw Emmett, I was doing my first poetry slam, and I didn't know anybody, and I was going in on my own, and I went in, I did my piece, and I came off, and I didn't get through to the next round, and that was all right. And I was like, there was some good poets there, you know, in the first round, and I was like, all right. And then Emmett was in the second half, and he did Northside, and I hadn't seen him before, and I was like, oh my God, this guy is outrageously talented. Like, I just hadn't seen that. And the way Northside, he brings you on a journey one way, and then it turns completely, and you're just I was flabbergasted. And I spoke to him outside, and he was like, oh man, I really loved your piece, you know what I mean? You have to come and do my gig. He was doing a gig in the Clockwork Door at the time. He had one on, I can't remember the name of the night. So I was like, oh yeah, absolutely, definitely. And then we started going to the same open mics, and it started to become this kind of unspoken competition between the two of us, where he'd do a piece and I'd be like, right, I have to get better than that. I just have to up my game. And then I'd do a piece and then it would challenge him, and it just became this kind of back and forth. And it was really friendly, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like there was any animosity, and it was just like he was setting the bar higher and higher and higher, and I was trying to set the bar, you know, of what I was writing. So it was brilliant for me as an artist, because I had this person to, you know, that I could share my writing with, that would challenge me about the stuff that I was doing. And then we just become ridiculously close over the years. We've shared the stage on so many occasions. We have just so much respect for each other, and we look after each other, and you know, we text and call every day. And my girlfriend, you know, she's like, is that fucking Emma on the phone again? I'm like, yeah, sorry, it's just Emma. But she knows how much I love him, and it's great. And then we get, like, and then he's like, we got booked to do Body and Soul there a couple of years ago, and I was like, oh man, this is gonna be brilliant, we're doing Body and Soul. And he just came, he was like, yeah, we're gonna write a whole new set for it. And I was going, what are you talking about, man? We're not writing a whole new set. I'm like, we have these love, and like, we know what pieces of ours are bangers. He's like, we're doing a whole new set, that's it, Jeff, and the two of us are gonna do it. So we did, you know, we wrote this, we did what, well, I haven't seen it before, where we wrote, like, what happens in rap music. I had this vision of it, what happens in rap music, where, like, as some rapper is going through a verse, another rapper will cut in and take half the verse off him and go back, and there's a flow back and forth. So I was like, okay, if we're going to do it, let's just write like that, and write so that we can flow between each other's pieces. And we wrote this big long festival piece, which is like, I think it's like 11 minutes long, and we wrote another piece as well, and so we just kind of like wrecked Body and Soul. It was so much fun, but I could only do it with it. He, like, Emmett is the poet that I would love to be, you know, like when I was growing up. Like, he has the confidence and the brashness, and he when you hear Emmett's poetry, you are getting a snapshot of how he thinks at that time, and there is no editing, and you know what I mean, like, there's a purity to what he writes. And there's a bravery to what he writes as well, you know what I mean? And I think he gives voice to an awful lot of people who are forgotten, you know what I mean? The kind of, like, some people in society that maybe don't have the voice that's needed. He's incredible. And I love performing with him so much. I love what he does. I love his poetry. I love when he shows me a new piece. I get excited by it. And I just think he's a really caring individual. Yeah, he's a great guy. I think he gets mistaken, like, a lot as well, you know what I mean? Like, people take some of his words out of context and kind of have a go at him. And it's very easy to take a single line and twist it in any way that you want. But you have to see the whole thing as a piece, you know what I mean? And I think with Emmett, you have to see the whole person. You know, so that it's him, you know, and he is beautiful and vulnerable and honest, and you know, he'll tell you how he feels. And I think it's very rare that somebody is like that. He's a really special person and a really special artist. Yeah. Can you tell that I love him?
He'll be delighted now when he hears this. I think that's kind of why you guys got on so well as well, because you're both kind of raw and vulnerable and honest about things that are going on. Like, you don't have a filter or hold back. So
yeah,
I think that kind of is,
we're outcasts as well, you know, like we don't fit in. Like, I don't fit into my friends. My group of friends that I grew up with, like, they hate that I'm a poet. They've never come, like, they don't come to my gigs, you know what I mean? That they're like the lads. It's kind of sport, and it's, that's the kind of thing. So me being an artist and outspoken is just, what am I doing? Like, what are you doing? So, like, Emmett's kind of the same, you know what I mean? So that we're outcasts, and we kind of find a general bond together. And it's great. Yeah. Connect.
Brilliant. I'm just getting a little bit conscious of time now. We're almost at the hour and I didn't even get to ask all the questions I wanted to. So that means we'll have to get you back in at some stage. Just before we head off, aside from the Connolly Festival, what else can we expect from you in the coming months?
Well, I've got the piece with Bipolar Bear coming out. So that will be, you'll see that around the city hopefully sooner rather than later. Actually, I have a few different projects coming up. I don't know if I can say all of them, but that's the big one that I'm looking forward to. I'm gonna have some new pieces. I want to do a gig, whether it's online or in person, hopefully in person, with a whole new set of all new material that I've got lined up. And I'm really looking forward to sharing that with people. And hopefully that, because this is the most prolific I've been in years, and I'm writing stuff that I really love. And again, you know what I mean? A lot of the time with the workshops and all the other stuff, I've written for other people, so I'm writing for myself again, which is lovely. Yeah.
Amazing. So we've got plenty of things to look out for and plenty of projects to come. So, Jeff, thanks a million for coming on and joining me and sharing all your stories and your
Thank
information.
Thank you for having with us. Me. You know, it's been lovely. And thanks, like, as I say, you're wonderful at what you do. I love your podcast, and you've really challenged me with the questions. They've been great. Yeah, thanks so much.